Papa, et non, en 2024, créer un site web n'est plus une galère. C'est devenu ultra simple, notamment grâce à des solutions comme Squarespace. Squarespace est la plateforme de site web tout en un pour permettre aux entrepreneurs de se démarquer et réussir en ligne, et ce, quelle que soit la taille de leur activité. Tout y est. Vous pouvez vendre vos produits physiques ou services en un temps record. Vous avez des centaines de templates de sites web canons dans tous les domaines. Vous pouvez créer vos propres campagnes email. Vous pouvez même vendre vos propres formations en ligne. Donc si vous voulez donner à votre business toutes les chances de se développer avec un outil à la fois performant et très simple d'utilisation, je ne peux que vous recommander d'aller sur le site squarespace.com. En plus, Squarespace vous offre moins 10% sur votre première commande de site web ou de domaine avec le code Pauline. N'hésitez pas et rendez-vous sur squarespace.com, code Pauline. Bonjour à tous, ici Pauline Léniaud et bienvenue dans un nouvel épisode de Crème de la Crème. Pour ceux qui ont déjà entendu les premiers épisodes, Crème de la Crème, c'est une conversation où j'invite des hommes et des femmes pour parler de leur réussite. L'objectif, c'est vraiment de partager avec vous les clés de leur succès, d'avoir des conseils concrets, leurs trucs, pour arriver à des principes réplicables que vous allez pouvoir appliquer à vos propres projets. Et je vous préviens, pour cet épisode, j'ai voulu quelque chose d'un peu différent. Là, j'ai fait un test. En fait, j'avais une opportunité à laquelle je pouvais juste pas dire non. J'ai une amie indienne, Pooja Dhingra, qui est juste une superstar en Inde. Une superstar dans son pays et qui est venue en France pour participer au jury d'un concours de cuisine avec des grands chefs comme Yannick Aleno ou Pierre Hermé. Alors vous connaissez peut-être pas encore Pooja, mais à 32 ans, elle a 500 000 de followers sur Instagram et c'est la reine des macarons de Bombay. Elle fait juste la pluie et le beau temps dans le food en Inde, côtoie les plus grandes stars de Bollywood et se fait inviter chez tous les grands chefs pour donner son avis sur ce qu'ils font. Surtout, ce qui m'intéressait, c'est qu'en plus d'être une chef de talent, Pooja est une femme entrepreneur remarquable qui a monté sa boîte à partir de rien à l'âge de 23 ans, en Inde, et a maintenant plus de 80 employés. Durant notre conversation, on parle de ses conseils aux aspirants entrepreneurs, de comment dépasser les moments de doute et apprendre de ses erreurs, des podcasts qu'elle écoute ou livres qu'elle recommande, de comment faire exploser son compte Instagram et des erreurs les plus communes à éviter, et d'un florilège d'autres choses qui donnent sincèrement bien souvent l'eau à la bouche. Bref, vous avez compris, j'ai pas pu résister à l'idée de vous la présenter. Et malheureusement, Pooja parlant assez peu français, il fallait le faire en anglais. Mais du coup, ceci est un test et on va faire le podcast en anglais. Donc attachez vos ceintures, parce qu'à partir de maintenant, je vais switcher sur l'anglais. Si vous ratez quelque chose, ne vous inquiétez pas, tout est sur le blog du podcast. Donc vous pouvez filer aussi sur www.podcast-crème-de-la-crème.com avec notes et références qui sont en anglais et en français, donc vous n'aurez rien perdu. Bref, assez parlé, et maintenant, je laisse place à ma conversation avec Pooja Dhingra, the queen of macaroons. Hello, Pooja.
Hello, Pauline.
I'm very happy to have you here in Paris, in my apartment. And so, in India, you're quite famous. In France, not yet, but it's going to come, of course. This was not planned, people, so the questions might be a little quirky sometimes, but I'm sure we're going to have a great experience. And so you may not notice, but I like to start with original questions. And so my first question is, can you tell me a little bit about Mount Fuji?
Thank you for having me. Mount Fuji. Okay, so basically I do this thing where I have a list of things I have to do every year. And these are goals that I set for myself, which I think I will not be able to achieve.
Ah, so you think so, it's like really hard goals.
I mean,
goals.
They're really hard goals. Like, it can't be something easy, right?
Okay.
Because then it's easily done. You have to push yourself to get it. So for example, I wanted to run the half marathon 2 years ago, which I did, which was a terrible idea. It was the worst thing I've ever done to myself. I'm not a runner. I wasn't really fit. And then I planned to do this, but it was done. I decided to speak French last year.
And we know that you do. And at one point, you will speak French during this interview.
You have to give me a bottle of wine first, and then we can do this in French. No. So Mount Fuji is... So one of the things left on my list was to climb a mountain. And I was reading a book with the story of, the founder of Nike, where Phil Knight, when he's starting his career, he goes to Tokyo. And people tell him, like, oh, you know, you should climb Mount Fuji. And he says that, I'll do it when I have something to celebrate, because it's a very spiritual experience and the Japanese think it's a mystical climb. And I read that and I was like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do.
Oh my
I'm
God.
Going to climb Mount Fuji, but I obviously have to tie it to a goal as well, okay, to celebrate
something. So the goal is not climbing Mount Fuji. It's a
layered goal.
Okay.
So the first goal is to grow our company and make it 10 times the size that it is.
Nice goal.
In 2 years. So in two years.
Wow. So there's a deadline.
Yeah. So August 2020. No, you have to have goals, always have to have like a finishing line.
Wow.
So August 2020. And I am not like, I don't think I'm fit enough today to climb Fuji. So it gives me 2 years to really get my act together and get super fit so that the climb is easy.
Because it's very difficult to climb Mount Fuji?
No, I don't think it's very difficult. It's a 6-hour climb.
It's not easy.
But still, you need to have a certain level of fitness to get there. So the next 2 years, it's going to be, so it's kind of like, you get a little bit lost when you're doing so many things. So it's like a focus. So if it's not getting me to 10X or it's not getting me to Fuji, I'm not doing it.
Great.
Yeah.
I love this. I love the fact that you like are so driven and have like specific goals like this. Do you like do this on the 1st of January of the new year or how does it happen?
No, it has to come. It's not something that I sit and say, what am I going to do now? But it's most of these things are things that I've just, you know, somehow like this Fuji thing just came when I read a book. The marathon thing came when I was in New York, actually. And it was my friend lived in a typical New York apartment, sixth floor, no elevator. Something similar
like
to yours.
Here.
Like yours. And, I was on holiday and I think I found it so difficult to keep going up and down her apartment. I said, wow, I'm a 28-year-old girl. I shouldn't find it so difficult. So I said, okay, I'm going to challenge myself and...
But you did it.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Not easy, but you said it was challenging
goals. I said, okay, so if I want to, reach a level of fitness, so a marathon seems hard enough. So let's do half a marathon and...
That's good enough, I think.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so if we come back a little bit to, so you're a chef, very famous in India. How did you come up to becoming a chef? And like, how did you decide that, baking basically and cooking pastry was going to be your life?
So I think, somehow I was always interested in food. I was always interested in baking. I always talk about the story of making my first batch of brownies when I was six with my aunt. And, it's for me, it was about transformation and like almost like magic because you take simple ingredients and, you put it in the oven and it comes out to be something so
magical.
Different, magical. So I think it was always there and I kept baking as I grew up, but I never thought like this is going to be my career.
I saw that your parents were in the food industry, right?
Yeah. So my
mom... like salty?
So my mom had a small chocolate business from home.
Okay.
So she was into baking. So I grew up looking at that, learning that. Mm. My father was he was a partner in some restaurants, but not really active. So, we always would go in and see what was happening. So we had a sort of... summer vacations running around a restaurant and all
nice.
Of that. Yeah, it was always the back of my head. But for some reason, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer.
Really?
Yeah.
that's quite different.
Yeah. So when I was 17, I actually went to law school in Mumbai.
Okay.
2 weeks.
Okay. You understood quickly it wasn't meant for you.
2 weeks. And I saw the books, I saw everything and... Mm-mm. I just knew that this is not how I see my life. It's not me. I'm a creative person. Mm. I like working with my hands. I always wanted to have a cafe. Like that was, the end goal. So I spoke to my parents about it and they were super supportive.
Really? I was going to ask because I'm sure, it's not easy to change careers. Law is reassuring
but
for parents,
exactly. But I think my parents have always been the kind to, you can do whatever you want as long as you're passionate about it, you're happy, it makes you happy.
Right.
They never had any restrictions for us. So the minute I told them that this is what I want to do, they said, okay, then you have to study, because education is important.
Yeah.
So go to school, you want to do hospitality, go to the best school you can find, do it, and then, take it from there.
So, following your passion, but still with
a
grand plan and rigor and some hard work.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's when you decided to leave India?
Yeah, so I left India. I was 17 and a half.
Honestly, Pooja, this is incredible. Like I know a lot of Indian and French people, etc., go and study abroad, but still it's like quite a stretch to go when you're 17 and go in a new country where you don't speak the language.
Yeah.
I know you went to Switzerland.
It was in fact beautiful. It was a life-changing experience because I think for me, I really understood who I am. I got to know myself better through the whole process. And mm-hmm. I think that Switzerland was just an eye-opening experience.
Because what do you mean, for instance?
For example, you're living with people from 60 different nationalities. Mm. Like, I feel like your view of the world is so small. Like, you only know your city, your neighborhood, mm-hmm. all of that, even though we traveled a lot. But those are the only people you know. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're in a room with your roommate is from Brazil. Mm. And, you know, you're sitting next to a German girl. And you're, you know, suddenly it's like so many different ideas. And you see their ideas of the world and yours. And it's just something that it was just, you realize how big the world actually is and the possibilities that are there. So I think for me that those years were very important. Uh-huh. I learned a lot about the world.
How long did you stay there? 2 years?
So the school was 3 years. 3 years. And then I worked, I did 2 internships. So I did for 9 months. So I was there for almost four years around.
And it was like majorly about pastry or was it like it about was general?
No, so it was the first year and a half was just food studies. Okay. And then after that was business and management.
So, awesome.
So we had courses in finance, we had marketing, we had sales, mm-hmm. we had entrepreneurship, leadership, mm-hmm. everything.
Great. I was, because I will have a few questions about like being both creative and the chef and the designer, you know, of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And also being the CEO and entrepreneur and businesswoman that you are and successful one. And I find it's always very schizophrenic and difficult to be the two. So I'm going to have questions about this later on. And so you did that. And after you went to Le Cordon Bleu, right?
In Paris, yes.
So why did you decide to do that?
So I think that when I was in Switzerland, we went through different departments and the pastry one was where I was happiest. And that's when it was like, a light bulb sort of just goes off. And you're like, yeah, this is what I want to do. And so I had to convince my parents. Okay. And they were like, okay, you've already gone for 4 years. It's a bit much. But then I said, no, I actually went to them with a game plan.
Okay.
And I said, this is it. I'm going to go to Paris. I'm going to study, come back, and I'm going to open this and I'm going to do this, this, this. And
had a grand plan.
Yeah. I told them everything before I left.
And did your grand plan, like at the time?
It was exactly the same. Yeah.
It was and it still is like close to what you're building right now?
Exactly.
Oh,
that's
awesome.
Yeah. So I told them that I went to Paris. It was beautiful. It is beautiful. Completely fell in love with the city and with everything that it has to offer. And it was just, butter, sugar, flour. Like,
what we love.
Yeah, and chocolate. Yeah.
And so how did the idea of building a brand, because this is super ambitious, how did you come up with this idea? Was it by visiting other pastry shops? What came up? You know, like you told me about building this cafe. So you do have a cafe, I know, with Lequels right now, the 15th. But you also, like, how did the grand plan come up?
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea was always to start my own business and my own pastry shop.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the way that Bombay is with the rent structure, it's just easier to have one central kitchen where you make everything and then have little kiosks. So for that format, it's important to have several locations. Mm-hmm. So it just sort of, just the logistics of it, I knew that I had to do multiple things.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just, you know, that was the idea to start with just, macaroons. And we'll get to that, I guess, at some point and how obsessed I am with them. But yeah, I had my first macaroon in Paris. And then I started asking myself, why isn't this available in India? You know,
at the time, there were strictly no macaroons or very few in India.
I mean, I'd never seen one.
Uh-huh.
Maybe in some hotels they were, but nothing in a standalone pastry shop.
Mm-mm-mm.
So I first saw it. I was like, what is this? Ate it, completely loved it.
Do you remember like your first memory of a macaroon?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's funny because I've repeated this story so many times.
Oh,
that it almost,
sorry.
No. But it feels like I relive it every time I say it, you know. And it's basically, I was at a party, my first weekend in Paris, I was at a party with some French friends.
Okay.
And, you know, and they were like, oh, what are you doing here? And I said, okay, I'm doing pastry. They're like, oh, which macaron do you like? Do you prefer Pierre Hermé or La Durée?
Uh-huh.
And I just looked at them like
who is Pierre Hermé?
What are these names? Like, what are you saying? And they were so shocked. They were like, you're learning pastry in France and you don't know what a macaron is, you don't know these people. And I was like, no, I don't know these brands. So they were like, tomorrow go and you have to try this macaron Mogador. And I was like, okay. So I went the next day in the 15th, close to where I used to live. And I went there and I stood in, I saw the shop and it was just beautiful and design. And I, you know, like, it's not what you think of when you look at, when you think of pastry or the pastry that shops that I was used to.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked inside and I saw these little macaroons that looked like burgers almost. And walked in and I bought the mocador.
Okay.
And I came out, a very expensive one.
Yeah, I must say. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not the cheapest.
Yeah. And I came out and I still remember it was like a windy day. And I, you know, I just looked at it and I was like, okay, let me see what the fuss is about. And I bit into it. And that was it.
Yeah,
you know,
explosion.
And passion fruit, I think, for me was also
It was chocolate and passion fruit.
So it was just like that mix and balance of sweet and acid and all of it just like crumb. Like it was just perfect.
I'm already hungry, Pooja. This is going to be very difficult.
Yeah. So I think, you know, and then I started asking myself, why? Why haven't I had this before? And then my family came to visit me and I took them and made them try everything. Uh-huh. And my father was the one, he's like, you have to do this. You have to make sure that,
Indian people
will love it. Because, and if my father likes something, he has the palate of a, you know, like he's the most, like the target audience of an Indian customer.
Okay.
So if he likes it, I'm sure everybody will like it. So I was like,
it's
okay,
always good having a target customer, like a person, you know, you can identify like your customer is always such a big help.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so that's when you decided to go back to India at that point.
Exactly. So I finished my course. I did a short 3-month internship in a chocolate shop in Paris.
Okay.
And then
where was that?
In the sixth, Jean-Charles Rochou.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I worked with him and he was incredible. And then it was time to go back home. It was very sad.
It's been like 5 years or something.
5 years being away and I missed Europe. I missed my life.
So you won't pretend you don't speak French.
I told you, wine bottle, and then I'm good. But yeah, it was very tough to go back. Mm. The first four months, I think I was very depressed. I was sad.
Yeah.
Because you go from a life of like full independence and full like doing what, you know, like just being able to, you know, just live your life, living alone, all of that, to going back to your...
Even if you love your parents, you go back to the parents' house.
And then, you know, it's even though they're super cool and stuff, it's still not the same.
Of course.
So it was a bit, you know. And then I just decided to start working on my recipes. Mm-hmm. And I just for my home kitchen, I just started experimenting.
So yeah, I was gonna ask you, like, what was the beginning of the process of Le 15th Patisserie? Was it like from your home, basically? You were alone?
Yeah, from my home alone, I just started, testing all the recipes that I had learned in Paris. And soon realized that nothing works.
Really?
Yeah, because everything was different. The ingredients, the temperature. So then I had to start modifying everything and seeing, okay, what can I do with this? What can I do with that? You know, this is the butter that's available to me. Mm-mm. It's not the same as French butter. It has more water. And then how does that change the recipe? So it was just about, you know, working, experimenting and changing things. And then soon enough, I think my mother got fed up of me being in the kitchen and wanted to throw me out and said, you need to get out and get your own place. So then, and at that point, I was also working on the macaroon recipe, which took me a lot of time get there, like lots of failed, you know.
Did you decide at first to have only a few recipes, like macaroons, for instance? And I know, like, because we met at the very beginning of Le 15th that you had the lemon tart at that point, but was it only few?
It was a few. You know, at that point, I think in India, everything is very excessive. Uh-huh. And everywhere you would go, menus would be like pages and pages long. And I never understood that. Mm-hmm. I thought that there's no way somebody can do so many things and do them well. Mm. So I always thought we'll do a page. We'll have everything on one page, whatever we can fit. And we'll just do the best to our ability. Mm. You know, there's no need to have 5,000 things. Let's do 5 flavors and make them really good. And that's how it started.
Mm-hmm.
And it started like in the beginning, it was... I started teaching, actually.
Really?
So I took
teaching pastry.
Yeah. So I took a central kitchen in Bombay, and I had quite a lot of space. We were only 3 employees, and we had to pay rent. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I went back, and everybody was asking me like, "Oh, what did you learn in Paris?" Like,
of course,
you know, and everybody wanted to know. And I just saw it as an opportunity, and I said, "If there's so many people who want to learn, let's teach them." Uh-huh. And you know, it was like a professional setup, because it was an actual kitchen. Uh-huh. You know, normally people
and was
classes.
It in a school already, or did you create your own school?
No, so we just converted a section of the kitchen into a studio.
Like a studio,
and we just started teaching from there.
Awesome.
And I got a couple of my friends from France that were helping me set up. So between the 2-3 of us, somebody would take a class and we would just teach them what we had learned. And it was, and that's what actually got us a lot of media attention.
Okay.
A lot of, you know, like we've never paid for any, we've never had a PR company or a marketing, nothing. It was just organic. We were lucky enough that we were doing something different at a time in India when no one was. And it was just organic. So people started noticing this. And then the cooking classes kind of gave, because they would come into our kitchen and they'd be like, they'd see the pastry and they'd see what you're doing. And then that made the pastry business, you know, kind of
But grow. It wasn't part of the plan initially. You hadn't thought about that. It just happened.
It just happened,
Right. And so at one point you decided to open your first corners or shops?
That you've been to, yes. That was the first one outside a little hair salon in Worli in Mumbai, So it was the salon that, you know, it was outside, was run by a friend. And she said, why don't you take a little corner outside and people can actually come and pick stuff up. And she gave it to me at a very reasonable rent. When I think about it today, I'm like, wow, that was really nothing.
She was helping you out.
Yeah, like the rents we pay today, I'm like, wow. And then I remember just sitting with a carpenter the night before, me, my friend Pratish, who does our design, and just the two of us sitting there with a carpenter and printing prints of, you know, all the food that we shot and putting it up in that little kiosk there. And it was so, you know, it was, raw. And
It was, but well, so for the record, what happened in the story behind our meeting with Pooja is that 7 years ago, I was doing an internship in India, trying to sell wine in India. That wasn't easy at the time. And so every day I would go in front of this salon because our apartment was just in front of it. And I would see this and I saw this Le 15 pâtisserie with, you know, the perfect French writing, like there was no mistakes in the spelling or etc. And I thought, wow, I need to try this. And I tried it. And it was insane because we'd been in India with my husband for 3 months and sort of missing some parts of French cuisine. And I remember biting into this lemon tart and just like explosion of taste, like so zesty, so good. I felt like I was in Paris again. And I was like, but this is incredible. It's the first time I'm tasting something in India that has such an authentic taste. And so we naturally wrote just to congratulate you and we met.
On my birthday.
Yeah, also it was on your birthday. So that we didn't know at the time.
Yeah. But yeah.
But it was great. So, I mean, I was very fascinated by your attention to details at that point and I still am today. And I don't know if you can expand on that and maybe elaborate, but it was very clear for a French person that you'd been to France and that you were really... Like
I think I have a, you know, when I was in Switzerland, I did an internship in a, you know, luxury hotel, which was part of the leading hotels of the world. And I was in housekeeping and my role was to go check the rooms every day after housekeeping and clean them to make sure everything was okay. And I still remember this one day my boss came and took me to a room and said, you've marked this as okay. Is it okay? And I'm looking around and everything looked perfect. Like it looked clean. Everything was fine. And she just looks at me and she's like, look again. And I'm like, okay, this lady's crazy. Like there's nothing wrong in this room. But then she walks to the couch and there was a little pillow which was kept with a little bit of a tilt. It wasn't straight. And she moved it and made it 90 degrees. And she said that that is perfection. And luxury is just attention to detail. It's the details that set us apart from a 3-star hotel or a 4-star hotel. And I think that just stayed with me. And it was just like... It's the little thing. So it's the, you know, when we made our boxes, the butter paper that we put with our logo in it, or the little ribbons that we tie on our boxes and, you know, how the placement of everything is. I think it's these little things that really make you stand out from and just makes, you know, adds that little bit of extra.
Extra value. And also, I think people know that it's for sure a 15th patisserie dessert because, you know, they can see the work and the details that have been put into everything. And is that something also you tried to put, because I know, so you work with Pratish, I meant that you're a designer, for instance, on the packaging and also on, I know, the retail also, even though they're corners.
I mean, with everything, I think the part that I enjoy the most is the actually the design aspect of everything, whether it's the design of the boxes or the dessert or, but the design is very important to me. And I think that I have a very strong opinion of what I like and what I don't like. And often, you know, I end up fighting a lot with my designer because of this. But we come to an agreement of what works. But I think that it's, it's completely an aesthetic that, you know, having lived in Europe for 5 years just stays with me. And and that's what I wanted to be. Like in India, I think everything was, you know, cake shops never really focused on branding. Uh-huh. No one had packaging. No one. It was just plain brown boxes. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that we did was, you know, decide to brand
that was intended because I remember you only had this small corner in Worli Seaface in Mumbai, and still the packaging was already perfect. And I think it's quite interesting, like, for people who are listening who may want to build brands, to understand that. Yeah. I mean, it's not always the case, but you had a very clear view of what
and
you wanted.
And it's important to start from the beginning, like when people interact with your brand from the start. You know, a lot of people I know back home, they'll start with something super basic and then say that once, you know, we become bigger, but you're not going to become bigger if you don't have that mindset from the beginning. So yeah, that was that's hopefully this trip has inspired me enough to go back and do some more fun things.
So it's an interesting question too, because I take charge of the design at our company in France, and I of course get very inspired by others or by other domains than jewelry. How do you get inspired, and is it something that is sometimes difficult, because, you know, sometimes you just get, you know, writer's block or designer's block?
It is difficult sometimes, and because it's a lot. Now, I've been doing it for 8 years. So how do you keep reinventing something, and how do you, you know, get your customers excited about something? But I think for me, my biggest inspiration comes from travel. And, you know, I was talking to this this restaurateur in Bombay who owns one of the biggest hotel chains and restaurant chains. And he said that, you know, we all go through different experiences in life, and we all have different we see things differently. But when an idea goes through you and your personal experience and comes out, it's so unique that no one will ever be able to copy it. And I think that's what it is. So whether it's travel, if I'm in Japan and I taste like a green tea, I don't know, like something financier there. And try and adapt that. Or if
I make it yours.
And I make it mine. Or I was in New York and I was just so, I was having all the cheesecake there. And I said, okay, how do we make New York meet Paris? So we did a cheesecake macaron we did a cheesecake choux pastry. So I think, like, it's about just using your experiences and then translating that into the menu. I think that's what really works for me.
For you, I understand. And if we talk a little bit more about maybe like the business part of your job, I think a lot of people who are business owners or aspiring entrepreneurs are listening to this podcast, at least in France. Can you talk to me about, like, first of all, did you have some mentors? So I understand you went to Switzerland and you learned business there, but I mean, doing it by yourself in India, being a woman, was something else. How did you...
How much time do we have for this question? No, I think... So I grew up... My father's an entrepreneur. He's built his own business. Okay. So I grew up looking at that, and I grew up kind of understanding what it is to run your own business, you know, like the amount of hard work it takes, you know, the kind of toll it takes on the family, and some days are not good, and the pressures and the stresses. Of course. I think we grew up understanding all of that. It wasn't sort of new. But then also... You know, it's going to school obviously helped, and I did learn a lot, but I don't think anything can prepare you for what it's going to be for when you start your own business. There are problems that come up every day you just think, like, even if I was writing a fictional story, I wouldn't believe that this is happening.
It's true.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's there are things that are so difficult. And I think that being an entrepreneur, your challenges never end. So the challenges I faced many when I started out, but I face even more today. They're just different. When I started, I was 23. I was young. I was a young girl trying to start something in India. But I think also youth, you know, I think people don't really give enough importance to youth. I think because you lack experience, you also think
differently.
Yeah, and you don't have the life experience to tell you what you can or cannot achieve. So you think you can do everything. And I think for me, that really worked, because I thought I can do everything. Obviously, then you realize what you can actually do. But for me, being a girl in India was about having people to take me seriously was very difficult. Whether it was if I had to sign real estate, or if I had to go buy machinery, if I had to find suppliers, like, they wouldn't take me seriously. I had to make my father call. So my father, even till like recently, my father would come with me when I had to sign property for, you know, like, lease something. Or luckily with the suppliers and everything now, you know, they want to come and work with us. But when we started, it was challenging with, and this is my favorite story to say, but when I started, I had some government officials that walked into the kitchen the first month, And they asked, they asked somebody like, where's the manager?
The owner, yeah.
And they, you know, my team called me and they saw me and they looked me up and they're like, where's the owner? And I was like, yeah, it's me. And they just looked at me really shocked. In Hindi, they asked me like, why is your husband dead? And and they said it in a manner where I was just like, okay, you know, like my husband doesn't need to be dead for me to be running my own business. But that's the kind of mindset that people come with, that most women don't really do much and do anything of their own. So I think breaking those barriers was a big challenge. Mm-hmm. The food industry is a very male dominated industry, and it's like a little, that's what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can either look at it as a, you know, deterrent or something negative for you, or you can just think that, okay, because I'm a young girl, I can use that to my advantage.
Yes.
And so many things, you know, there are negatives, but there were so many other positives as well.
It's also a way, I guess, to stand out in a way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You stand out, you have an opinion, you have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, you clear the path for so many people who follow you afterwards, which, you know, when I started culinary school, not that many people were pastry chefs. Not that many people went to culinary school. And now it's everybody. I ran into someone on the road yesterday in Paris and they were like, oh my God, you know, we're in school here. And it's a great feeling to do that or be able to help someone, you know, lead to get to their sort of goals. Mm. So
Did you have some down moments and how did you get through the down moments?
Like, Every day has one down moment.
Yeah, I sometimes say, you know, being an entrepreneur is having 20 down and 20 very like hyperactive up moments per day.
You know, like we sit in the office and it's just every hour is like, I was like, this, my life should be a movie, because the drama that follows every day is just inexplicable. Like it's just, yeah. So the downs are many. I mean, from things not going the way you want, mm-hmm. not being, you know, getting a property that you want.
Of course.
Something that you create, a menu that you make, which you think people will love, that, you know, people don't like.
Of course. But it's always reassuring to know that even successful people have failures and have issues and have problems.
And I think everybody has failures, right? Mm-hmm. It's just whether you choose to learn from them or just completely let them take over, right? At the end of the day, you have to be very pragmatic about the way you work. You can't hold on to your failures. It's not just because something has failed doesn't make you a failure, right?
Course.
It's just something that you did that didn't work.
Of course, that's a very sound way to put
it. I mean, like if we opened one kiosk a few months, like last year, in an office building, and it didn't perform. It didn't do the way we wanted, and it's always sad when a business doesn't do the way you want it to. I mean, we shut it. You know, it was a financially non-emotional decision. It just wasn't doing it for us, and we closed it. We opened something else that's doing really well. Mm-hmm. So it's about trial and error, and not like taking everything so personally and feeling that you are a failure because an idea that you had didn't work.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite failure, like a failure that you know? That really changed something in your way of thinking or in your life? It can be non-professional too.
No, professionally as well. I think for me, the last 6 months have been completely, you know, it's taken my life and turned it upside down. As you know, we've expanded and we've raised some capital. And in the process, I think the kind of person that I am, I'm a very trusting person. And I've had the same, you know, core members of the same team for over the last 7 years.
Uh-huh.
And through the process, when I found out that when a very trustworthy employee was stealing from us,
it's very, very difficult.
And not only stealing, but stealing large amounts of money and to the extent of like forging my signature on bank loans.
That's insane.
And then, you know, it's like a slap in the face, not only because you were so, obviously there's the loss of money, but it's also it's heartbreaking because the trust that you had, and then that changes you as a person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm a completely different person than I was 6 months ago.
You feel that now you're not as trustworthy, or maybe you put some new processes so that you don't have to be trustworthy?
Exactly. I mean, the thing is that now the processes are definitely in place and everything is led by processes and not emotion.
Mm.
You know, and I think that that is the biggest change that I've made in the last 6 months because of this
failure.
And I think that it's it was a tough one because, you know, like and I think that's something that I see like my male counterparts do very well, because I think as a woman, I'm more, empathetic and emotional. Yeah. And it works really well to lead teams sometimes, mm-hmm. but also then sometimes people take advantage of that.
Of course.
So to learn how to balance that and understand business is business and you have to learn how to keep that in check. Mm-hmm. I think for me, that has been the biggest lesson and mm-hmm. a failure sort of that completely changed mm-hmm. the way I think and the way I do run my business mm-hmm. today.
And if we talk about positive things about the success of Le 15, so when I first met you 7 years ago, you had one corner in Wallis-y face. Now you have a lot of shops, five shops, 80 employees or more.
Yeah.
It's insane how successful you've been. I mean, it's not insane. It's of course, it's normal, but I mean, you've been quite successful. What for you were the key moments that led to this success? Can you identify a few steps that you took or maybe risks that you took that led to this success?
I think when you're in day in and day out working, like each day, it's just you don't realize, like you look up one day mm-hmm. suddenly and you're like, okay, we've become a team of 40 and today we are 80. And it's like you're just so engrossed and so involved in it that you don't really step back uh-huh. and take a look at it from, I think
another
for me, I think... And this is something that I wish I had done earlier, was to hire really, professionals to do things for you. You have to realize at some point that you can't do everything. Mm-hmm. And I think as entrepreneurs, you want to control and micromanage and do everything. Mm. And delegating is something that we all have an issue doing. But I think that...
Because when an entrepreneur, you want to do things, you want to produce things.
But you can't do everything. Yeah. And I think for me, the biggest challenge was to be able to let go. Mm-hmm. And, so I think for example, hiring a head of operations or hiring mm-hmm. a great, a human resources team or, things that I was taking. So it basically you're taking away from, your core mm-hmm. competencies and what you're good at. So I don't think, going back to your question, I don't think there's been moments where I feel like this was actually the turning point. Uh-huh. It's just been put your head down, keep working, keep setting goals, uh-huh. reaching them, and then reflecting on how you can change uh-huh. it and become better at it.
Great. And so it's a very good transition towards your sort of daily routines or what does your day look like? I like this question because I mean, you're a pastry chef and I worked in a pastry when I was younger and basically waking up was 5 a.m. or earlier and sleeping was just not an option. So I would love to hear what your day looks like.
It's really funny because if you asked me this question 6 months ago, I would say, I don't know. But now, ever since I've got a team in place and my assistant, uh-huh. who's this super ninja, as I call her, she's a computer engineer who wrote to me on Instagram, said, I want to work for you. And she's transformed my life. Every minute of my day is accounted for. So if it's not on your calendar, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So
are you just on Google Calendar?
So everything. Yeah. We use Google Calendar and she has access to it and everything. So even if I'm, in a meeting somewhere, it'll be there. If I'm, and everything, I have Instagram breaks.
Oh my
actually
God.
Take breaks.
Really?
So, yeah.
Because you mean you do not go and post anything on Instagram? Is that the Instagram break?
No. The Instagram break is through the day. Like I don't have to, I don't check my phone every 5 seconds. Uh-huh. I keep it aside. I finish a task that I'm doing.
Okay.
And then at the end of every hour, I have 10 minutes where I can take
a break. So you're allowed.
Break.
Okay. So it's the opposite.
It's the opposite. It's a break to go to Instagram.
Okay.
So I think the day starts at 6 a.m. Uh-huh. In the morning is when I usually try to get done with all my exercise. So it's either yoga or running or gym.
Awesome.
1 hour of that every day.
Wow.
I try to get into the kitchen by 8:30. Mm-hmm. The team comes in earlier. And then I'm there the whole day, and then it depends. It's spending time with different departments. I try to take at least 3 hours a day in the kitchen, whether it's testing new recipes or mm-hmm. looking over what's happening, seeing the purchases, seeing everything, mm-hmm. controlling. And then there's a lot of meetings because we work with a lot of people. We have a lot
partners.
Of fun collaborations, mm-hmm. partners. I try to go to the different locations. I don't get to go every day, but at least, mm-hmm. once in a way. And then it's just... Before I know it, it's 11 o'clock at night and it's time to get my
Because I think you mentioned this past week to me that basically you stop working around at 10, 11. Is that something that is, you think, a necessity because of your job, or are you planning to try to work less?
I just love it. It's there. You just want to be there. There's no reason for me to be there. Like, my new office has a bed in it. My parents are so afraid they're not going to see me. But the thing is that I would rather be there than be anywhere else. You know, it's just that I love my job. I love being there. If I sometimes feel like I want to go out, watch a movie, meet a friend, I'm lucky enough to have that flexibility. I can go for lunch. I can do whatever I want. But I'd rather be in the office. And the thing is that it's just, for me, I get only a couple of hours when no one really bothers me. Mm-hmm. And this is between 8 to 10 in the morning. Uh-huh. And then once everyone leaves at 8 in the evening. Mm-hmm. So 8 to 10 again in the evening. So that's the time when I actually get time to me, when my phone is not ringing, when no one is coming and asking me questions. So that is thinking time for me.
That's great. And, so that's the moment when you really like try to analyze
what's happening, plan for the next week, the next menus. We have new things coming up every now and then. I'm writing my third book, so I get some writing time. Yeah, I get some writing time. So it's just that, you know, I like being there.
And so you mentioned the fact that you don't sleep too much, even though you have a bed in your office. So there's this like ongoing story about chefs not sleeping at all.
Yeah, no, I sleep. I get around 6.5 hours, which is
good enough,
right? Yeah. I get home by around 11:30. I'll watch TV. I'll watch my Trevor Noah, if he's listening to this. If anyone knows him, I want to marry him.
Duly noted.
So then I sleep, and then I'm up by six. So I get a 6.5 hours. Yeah.
Is there like the fact that you, for instance, sleep at the same time and go to bed at the same time every evening, does it help you? Like, do you have a specific routine to help you? Because for me, 6 hours of sleep is honestly just below what I would need. I would be more like a 7 hour person. Yeah. And I find it's very difficult for me to be productive if I don't have like on a long-term basis, you know, enough sleep. Yeah. So I would like to know how you came up to being able to sleep only like 6 hours, which is
It's usually between six and seven is what it is. And I've always been like that. It's, you know, for the longest time.
You don't need too much sleep.
Yeah. It's like, I can't even on vacation now, if it's more than 6 an hour, like I'm just up and about. Every now and then I will like to, you know, maybe once every 10 days or 14 days, I'll sleep in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Means wake up at 8 instead of 6. But
A very long night.
But it's just that there is always so much to do, and, you know, I'd rather be in yoga or something than sleeping. Yeah.
So you're a little bit of an action addict.
Exactly.
Perfect. Another thing I wanted to talk about is your Instagram account. So you have almost 500,000 people following you on your Instagram.
Yeah, thanks for telling that to the bartender.
Yes, so there's a very interested bartender, by the way, in France. He likes Pooja very much. And also the fact that she has a lot of followers. And so, I mean, I thought it would be interesting for people to understand like how you came to get interested with Instagram, because it started quite early at a time when Instagram was not known. Yeah. And was it like a thought through decision to, you know, become like an influencer into food, or did it just like happen? Can you describe that?
It's never been anything that's been planned. I still remember my first Instagram post was 7.5 years ago
when Instagram just started. How did you come across Instagram?
I saw a friend use it. You know, I saw somebody's, I love these pictures that have like these treatments on it. Uh-huh. And I saw someone use it. And I said, oh, how do you get it? And they said, it's this app, but it's only available on the iPhone. And I had just switched from an iPhone to a BlackBerry. So I went back and got an iPhone so I could get Instagram.
Wow.
And I just started. And I think, you know, with food is so visual, right? Like,
Of course.
I was doing it for Facebook anyways. That's how we were, you know, I think in the age of social media, you're so lucky that you don't have to go too far to get people to find you.
Of course.
So I think I was already doing it on Facebook, putting up albums of our food. And I just, Instagram works great for food because visually, you know, it's you put up what you eat. And I just started doing that. And for me, it's, you know, I've always been a very communications or talking about what I'm doing or what I think is always has come easily. So for me, it's like almost the phone is an extension of my hand. And it's, you know, like something that I don't even think about it. Like, I know some of my friends, they'll be like, you have to stop posting so much. And for me, it's just like,
Do you stop yourself from posting?
So basically now that Insta Stories has come, it's so much easier because you don't have to think about it. But before, I used to do at least 7 posts a day.
Oh my God.
And it used to be, I never felt like it was overwhelming because it was always different and it was taking you through the day. And I feel like it just makes people connect to you, to your brand. They understand you. They get to see a side of you that, you know, that they would normally not see. And so it's never been planned. It's not been like this whole, I don't know, I just take pictures and I put them up. It's never been a...
Would you have, by any chance, any tips maybe for, or maybe common mistakes that you see that people make on Instagram?
You know, I think what really shows is if it's truthful and honest. Mm-hmm. So I think if your picture is true to who you are, what you're doing, if it's not like this fake, too real, too perfect sort of situation. But I think that if you are your true self and let your personality come through out through your pictures and what you post, I think people connect with that, with the realness of it, like rather
and
than
maybe
just
also the consistency.
I think that's important as well, right? Because, and especially the way now Instagram has changed its algorithm. So, you know, you only see posts from people who post a lot and, you know, using hashtags and things like that. Like there is a science. I know that people say if you post at a certain time of day, if you post how many posts a day, but I've never really looked at anything. I just go with instinct. If I see something I like and I want to post it, I post it. If I don't, then I...
And are you more now of a story person or an Instagram like picture, static picture person?
I do both. I love them both. I try to do like maybe 2 or 3. It's like, you're an addict. Yes, I know. I'm addicted to it. But I love it. I like to do 2 or 3 posts and then maybe just Insta stories through the day. Yeah.
Another question I wanted to ask you, it's a little like dissolute, but we talked about books and about also podcasts. So that's something that really interests me. Yeah. You told me you do listen to podcasts. What podcast, for instance, you listen to?
I got into it very recently, maybe 6 months ago. And then, you know, I've been completely hooked.
Really?
I listen to a lot of the Tim Ferriss. I listen to NPR, like how I built this. I
love Freakonomics, maybe.
Yeah, Freakonomics. I love all the TED Radio Hours. Mm-hmm. I listen to all, like, I know it comes out on Friday and I'm always, you know,
More about business than food.
Yeah, I like to listen to, I do both. I do some on food, but not so many. But there are some on food, but I like most, like, so when I was learning French, I did a lot of French podcasts.
You need to listen to Crème de la Crème.
So I did a lot of French podcasts. I think to learn anything new, it's great. It's also for me when I, you know, I'm walking or running or, you know,
it's something great that you do while doing something else.
And the best time, what I found is that because, you know, traffic and distances in Bombay are just so crazy. Mm. So from one of my cafes to my kitchen almost takes 40 minutes by car. And I felt like I was wasting that time. You can't do much then. I don't like talking on the phone.
Yeah.
So I just switched to podcasts and I just, by the time I'm there, you know, you feel like
you've learned something.
Utilizing your time. So I pick a topic, whether it's leadership, whether it's, you know, my favorite one is the Oprah story, like how Oprah built her business.
Really? Is it on what podcast?
It's called
is
Making Oprah.
Okay, I'll check it out and put the link.
Can find, and then they have Making Obama, and it's, you know, awesome. It's like all these great stories, and you know, it's amazing. So I have like a bunch for my train rides, plane rides, all of them. And
that you prepare in advance.
Yeah.
And so what about books? I heard you were reading right now. So Tribe of Mentor. No, was it? What was it? It was Tools of Titan.
Yeah.
Right? Tim Ferriss again.
The new one. I've just started reading it. It's very interesting.
Okay.
It's just, I love that you can open it up to any part of it.
You don't really have to read it through and through.
Yeah. Mm. And so my goal for this year, one of the goals for this year was to read 50 books.
Wow.
So 50 books in 2018. So that's almost like 4 books a month.
That's huge.
Yeah. It's.
But podcasts count, you know, but they're sort of like books.
No, but I think like, again, so if I listen to a podcast one way of the trip, the way back, I'll read I always have my Kindle. But I love reading. I've always loved reading ever since I was little. And I thought that I was spending so much time with my phone and not. Mm-hmm. And I missed, you know, actually.
Yeah, that's touching what I things said. And stuff.
So the only way I can get myself to do something is if I tell myself I can't do it. So this 50 books is going great. I think I'm on book 14.
Awesome.
I'm a bit behind schedule, but I'm going to use this holiday and long flights to catch up.
And also the way back to Mumbai is going to be a great opportunity.
Exactly.
Would there be a book that maybe helped you and that you would recommend to aspiring entrepreneurs?
Honestly, the Nike book that I just read.
I don't remember the title. Running or something. Speed, isn't it?
Oh my God, how can I forget the name of this?
Supposed to be your favorite book, Pooja.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
I'll look it up. Don't worry.
It'll come to me. But anyway, so somebody actually saw on Instagram that I'm doing this 50 book challenge and people started sending me books that they like. And it was incredible. Like, it's just amazing. So they send me this book and, you know, I just started reading it like, okay, but I never expect to fall in love with it. It was just one of those books that you have goosebumps with, or, you know, when you're reading and you understand that, you know, what it was like to build a brand like Nike. I mean, and the failures and the, you know, you get it. Like, and it gives me sort of hope that it's, everyone goes through like rough patches. Yeah. It's normal. And another book that I read was Open, which was the Andre Agassi book.
Oh, yeah.
Book.
It's supposed to be very
good.
Oh,
my God. I couldn't put that one down. That book.
Even for non-tennis players.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't play tennis. Mm-mm. I don't understand tennis. But that book was just, I couldn't put it down. I became obsessed with him after that. He starts the book by saying that he hates tennis. I mean,
that's crazy.
It's crazy, yeah.
Well.
Shoe Dog. Sorry, it just came to me. That's the name of the book.
Shoe Dog?
The Nike book. It's called Shoe Dog.
Perfect. So I have a little blog for the podcast, and so I'll put it down anyway so you people can find it. Don't worry. So two more subjects I wanted to talk to you about is you mentioned it earlier, is being a woman in India, a woman entrepreneur in India. So maybe you know in France, there's been this huge movement. It's called Balance Ton Port, like basically women trying to... How could I say
this? Is it like the Me Too movement?
Yeah, it is. And it's been quite present in France. And I think also trying to find more inspirational women and you know, trying to like be more together and build a community of women like working and being entrepreneurs is something pretty powerful. Also in the podcast business, by the way. And so it was really interesting for me to have you on the podcast because, I mean, I'm sure it is difficult in France, but I mean, honestly, in India, I can't even imagine like what were the challenges that you faced. So I know you do like challenges, but could you elaborate a little bit? So you mentioned the fact that, you know, those guys came in your kitchen, et cetera, but... Like, what would be maybe pieces of advice that you could give to aspiring entrepreneurs that are women?
I think it's important. Like you said, it's important to find a support system. It's important to get like this. And I think for me, it's, you know, organically built over the last couple of years when I met different women in different fields. And it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know,
it can be men too, by the way.
Yeah, and men too. Exactly. But I think like it's important to not hold on to too many things. You know, for me, I was just so focused on what I was doing that I didn't really see this side of it.
Yeah.
Today when I reflect and I say, okay, this could, but I was just so busy building and creating. And I think for every person that I met that was, you know, sort of sexist or, you know, didn't take me seriously, I met a whole different bunch of people who believed in my dream and who encouraged me. And I chose to focus my energy on
and
that.
And your attention on those people.
And other than that, but also then meeting different women from different industries, understanding their challenges.
Was that something that you pursued like actively, trying to meet women like mentors or something?
Yeah, I mean, I see them more as equal. So I have, you know, people in the, like back in at home, I have like some of my closest friends today are super successful women in their own you know, fields. And it's great because when you meet them, you understand that everybody's going through the same challenges, whether it's fashion, it's design, it's, you know, art, Bollywood, whatever it is. Like, it's good to have this tribe that you can, that, you know, you kind of, you all relate to each other and all of that. And I think it's, if women don't support women, that's when the problem happens,
of course.
I think it's a fight between our gender too, than not just men and women.
Of course.
Yeah.
There are a lot of women that are very competitive because I guess it's not easy. And so sometimes it's even worse, you know, the competition is usually worse between women than between men and women. Another question that really interests me is like, I don't know if this is the case in India, but sometimes women are a little bit like shy maybe, and you have such a drive and an energy, you talked about it. And I feel that sometimes women like overinterpret or want to be too respectful or maybe try to be just like nice, you know, with the people they meet, and so don't really go through or don't challenge enough or don't know how to say no.
Yeah.
Is that something also that you see, and how did you, was it a tendency you had to, or did you have to overcome it?
No, I think that it's completely right. I agree with this observation. Mm-hmm. And I think that women just hold back, you know, you don't want to give your opinion on something. Exactly. I know of a colleague who was talking about, you know, when she works somewhere else, she's like, if I hadn't to give an idea, I would have to struggle and say, maybe, you know, this is, if the room agrees, like, this is my idea. Like, but if a man would just stand and be like, this is what I, you know, I think. And I think it's girls have always been taught, at least culturally for us, to stay quiet, to not speak their mind. Mm-hmm. You don't want to seem more intelligent than the boy, like all these, you know, grandmother's tales sort of things. Yeah. But I do see that changing a lot now. And I see that in the dynamic is sort of in different fields that I think it's changing. Mm-hmm. But it is a problem, I think, for even me today, if I was in a room full of like men, you know, like male chefs,
of course,
I would, you know, even
feel
though
uncomfortable.
I wouldn't be, even if I'm running my own business for 8 years, as bad as this sounds, but I wouldn't have the arrogance of a man who's, you know, he would just naturally be more confident and naturally have that sort of, you know, and that's something that I struggle with a lot. And I whenever I catch myself like doubting myself or not being, I have to remind myself that, you know, hey, you've earned a seat at this table.
You deserve to be here.
Yeah.
It's true, but it's not easy. I mean, we all know sometimes that we lack confidence, but building confidence and having, you know, tricks to build confidence, like the one you just mentioned, is really not easy. And so I was
I think it starts with self-awareness. The minute you realize that you're doing this to yourself or this is a situation you're in, I think that's the first step.
Yeah. And sometimes then, also people just like write, you know, words on their, like over their bed shelf or something, just saying like, I am where I need to be or something, like you just need to.
Affirmations are great. I mean, there's something that, you know, I believe in affirmations a lot. And I think that building confidence is something for, it's a work in progress and it's not something that you're just born with and it comes easily. For me as well, like it's something that I need to work on constantly, and whether it's, you know, perfecting a skill that I think I need to, or challenging, setting goals for myself, or pushing myself so that I, you know, like whether it's running the marathon or doing anything, it's just, it's not for anybody else, but it's for me to know that if I put
it's
my mind to something, I can do it.
Yeah. Of course. But I find that your idea and your, you know, trick in a way of building challenges is great, because it's really like, trying to find new things to do and building new confidences in, maybe you're, if you're not a sports person, doing a marathon or going up Mount Fuji is such a good way, building milestones to overcome your own, you know, failures and doubts. So I would advise people to do something like that. Perfect. And so my last question is something quite nice, I think, and because I'm starting to get a little hungry, is about pastry cooking. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, like, throw through a few things, like about like your favorite, for instance, what's your favorite dessert?
Oh, that's a challenging
one. The macaroon,
one, right?
Of course.
The macaroon is, but I think if I had to go back to something that's very comforting, it would be a dark chocolate cake with maybe some salted caramel in the center.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. And so, I mean, you mentioned the macaroon, but is there with Pierre Hermé, but is there another like pastry souvenir that really impacted you and that you remember specifically? Like you had an emotion because you felt like, wow, I don't know, this reminds me of something, or?
So I think the Pierre Hermé macaroon was more like, it was like a moment of wow. But I think when I was in London a few years ago, I had a very simple custard. And it was just something that was so simple and was so basic, but it connects with you because it's something that you've grown up having. But it was just, the balance of it was so perfect, and you're just in awe of it because something that's so simple can taste so delicious.
Did you try to reproduce it at Le 15th?
I try to do it all the time, but I think it was the setting or the ingredients or what.
Maybe just, that plays a part too. Yeah. That plays a part. What are for you the most important qualities of a chef, which are probably not the same than the ones of an entrepreneur?
I think for pastry, especially, patience is most important. It's a process that you can't rush. And I see it with, you know, between pastry and cooking, like you have to be patient. You have to be precise. Mm. Precision is important. Everything, baking is a science and everything has to be measured and be correct. You can't, like, you know, when you cook, I'll put a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah,
it doesn't work.
Different.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's never going to work. So precision. And Yeah, so I think those two are
the most important qualities.
The most important.
And
yeah.
And as an entrepreneur, like a woman or not entrepreneur, yeah. whatever, would you know maybe like qualities that you would
again,
like
I
to
would,
find?
Yeah, I would go with perfectionism.
Perfectionism,
maybe, but I would, patience is one which is very important because I think we're a generation that wants results now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
that's
we want
the fault of Instagram.
Instant gratification, right? No, but I think that patience is one which is, and persistence, right? Like to keep going at it, that doesn't matter, you know, if you fail roadblocks or if whatever happens, that, okay.
Having an end goal like yours also is something, I guess, that helps also because, you know, you just have this road in front of you and you just have to go through, of course. And my last question is about the cake or pastry that you baked you are the most proud of. Do you remember? Is there something you were so proud of it?
I mean, this is a tough one, huh? You tricked me. No, I think we've done many challenging things at Love 15. We've done crazy shapes and this, but I think the biggest, the most challenging one was a wedding cake that we made for a Bollywood star, Salman Khan's sister, for her wedding 4 years ago.
Okay.
And it was in a different city. It was a different kitchen. It was 150 kilos.
Wow.
It was 8 tiers.
Wow.
Some of the tiers.
It could have been like a Guinness record book.
It was crazy. It took us 8 people 3 days to put it together.
Wow.
Some tiers were hand painted. Some were like with the detailing that we did on it. Really, when we saw that, you know, we saw it, it was just a moment of, wow, we've done this. So I think that's one that I'm super proud of.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And lastly, is there like, something you'd like to add or like, something we didn't mention in the podcast? And you mentioned your books. You mentioned the fact you're writing a new book also. That's something we didn't talk about.
No. I think as, if you're listening to this and you're an entrepreneur and you're getting to, you know, planning to start something new, I think what really works for me is to see each failure and look at the lesson that it's teaching me.
Mm.
Because I find that my biggest successes come from the biggest failures. Mm, like, you know, whether it's, you know, the thing that I'm challenged with most, if I tackle it, instead of running away from it, if I actually take it, whether it's a personality thing, whether it's a weight issue, whether it's, something that I don't understand completely, I do believe that everything happens for a reason, and that's, you know, my motto in life. So look at what is happening to you and why is it happening to you? What is it trying to teach you? And if you can overcome that, I think that's where success for you truly lies.
Yeah. Great, great end finishing notes. But I completely agree. And also what I find is that it makes failures more easy to cope with because when you know that you're actually learning something from it, I mean, when you feel it in your gut, that it's actually something useful for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly, I'd rather, what I don't like, so some entrepreneurs say doing a mistake is not bad. What's bad is doing it twice. And it's very true. I think you really need to stay focused on like doing mistake is fine. What you need to is to learn from it. And it's not that easy. So you really should know, identify when it's a mistake because that's not easy and then learn from it. So I guess it's a good way to go.
Having no ego is the biggest
challenge. For all of us, I think. Well, I don't think you have that problem. But so thank you so much, Pooja. If there are by any chance people that don't know where to find you listening to this podcast, where would they have to look? Maybe for the 15th, first of all?
Yeah. So you can check our website, which is le15.com.
Le 15 with the Le 15 written.
Just le15.com.
Yes, 15.com.
You can go to our Instagram, which is le15patisserie, or my personal one, which is at Pooja Dhingra.
I'll spell it out. So Pooja Dhingra is Pooja Dhingra for those French people listening to us that don't know Pooja yet. And anyway, I'll put everything in the notes of this episode on the podcast blog, which is podcast-crème-de-la-crème.com. And I'll compile them in French so that you French people that listen to podcasts and maybe missed a few elements can find everything, and also in English so that our Indian friends can of course check out everything. Thank you so much, Pooja.
Thank
it was
you,
a
Pauline.
Pleasure. I'm so happy.
Let's go eat ice cream.
Yes.
Hey guys, a last few things before we finish. First of all, if you want to contact Pooja, see pictures of Pierre Hermé's infamous macaroons, or just see the references of this episode, just go on www.podcast-crème-de-la-crème.com. That's the link to the blog of the podcast, and you will find everything you need. Also, if you want to contact me to ask me questions, give me feedback, or simply suggest other guests, really feel free to do so on the blog directly or via my Instagram and Twitter accounts, which can be found at Pelignau, so that's handle PLAIGNEAU. Lastly, if you have a few spare minutes and you enjoyed this episode, really, it would be absolutely great if you could drop a 5-star grade or comment on iTunes. It really, really helps to promote the podcast and gives me energy to continue in this wonderful venture. As always, thank you so much. I really hope you enjoyed listening to Pooja, and I just hope to see you soon for a new episode of Crème de la Crème.